You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, May 28th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Kara, you're just touring the world and doing all kinds of stuff, but you have time for the SGU this week, which we love.
Yeah. I'm so excited. Yeah, so we're recording a different night than usual because you guys were all so nice to kind of be flexible with my banana schedule.
We're and very
actually
flexible.
Did work this morning. I was in like a little sound studio in Hollywood shooting some stuff for Brain Games, and I was able to meet a friend for lunch, so I had to drive all the way across town. And I'm sitting in traffic, you know, because I live in LA, and I'm driving across town, and I'm blasting the music so loud, and I'm just really into it. You know when you're really into it, and you're singing at the top of your lungs, and you've got, like, dance moves, and, like, nothing can distract you from how just zoned out you are listening to your music. So I'm going hard. I'm sure I look ridiculous, but I'm not thinking about that at that point. And I'm sitting at a red light, and I look over, and this guy is trying to get my attention.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, oh, God, how long has he seen this? And then I notice he's holding up his phone, and I'm like, oh, God, was he recording me? And I start to get creeped out. But then he starts pointing to his phone, like gesticulating a lot and pointing to his phone. And so I turn down my music, and I roll down my windows, and I waved at him. I'm like, hi. And he's like, I know you. I'm listening to you right now. And he's holding up his phone. And I can see that he's listening to an episode of SGU.
Oh, my God. That is awesome.
Right. And I was like, I'm so sorry I didn't notice you. I was really into my song. Nice to meet you. And kind of drove off. It was hilarious. It's like, wow, that's so weird. It just happened like in my neighborhood, too.
And that was it? Then he drove away?
Yeah, we both drove away.
Oh, that is really
That's
cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so, hi, I didn't get your name, but it was nice to meet you. Maybe you can write us an email. Tell us who you are.
That is kind of a weird thing. Imagine being the person you're listening to a podcast, then you see one of the people from the podcast you're listening to next to you in traffic. That would
and
be weird.
I guess, too, he must have recognized my car first, I would think, because, you know, my car has a talk, and my license plate says Talk Nerdy.
Talk Nerdy, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like I talk about my electric car all the time on the show, because I can't imagine that he would have recognized me if I was, like, going hard with the dancing and the singing. I'm just unsure.
I would love to hear his side of the story. Like, you know, so I'm driving to work, and I'm pissed, but I'm listening to the SGU, and then I see Kara, you know, like...
Not sure if she can see me because she's really into it.
She's gyrating. And,
I thought she was having a seizure at first.
Exactly.
So I was getting ready to dial 911 when suddenly.
How often do you guys get recognized in the wild, as I like to say?
I got recognized in the supermarket.
Yeah?
It's weird.
It's rare. It's rare.
It's rare. I got recognized on an airplane coming back from the solar eclipse in 2017. I got noticed.
That's cool. It happens to me sometimes because I do TV work.
Yeah, you do more TV work.
So
sure,
sometimes people will recognize
visual
me.
Visual exposure, yeah.
And I may have told you guys about this before, but one time I was hiking with my boyfriend's parents were in town and we were hiking in Griffith Park and some girls stopped to ask for directions to something. And I started to give them directions. And then they're like, are you Kara Santa Maria? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, I recognize you by your voice.
Wow. Yeah,
like,
yeah,
they didn't know what I look like. Isn't that so weird?
I got that, but I had a little twist to that one. I was at a haunted convention, and I asked a question during a little seminar, and somebody came over to me. It's like you won SGU, and I was like, yeah. But what was even the most hilarious thing though was that he thought I was Jay.
I love that.
The Novella Brothers.
Oh my God!
It's I forgot. Weird that people can't tell you guys apart. You sound so different.
Yeah, well, now that you know us so well, Kara, you hear
why.
All the inflections and everything.
I get what I get a lot of at work is, are you the Dr. Novella from the podcast? I'm like, yeah. Did you think there was another Dr. Novella? I guess there probably is somewhere. But
do you ever have are they patients or is it other like healthcare providers?
Everything. Most recently, it was an ICU nurse.
Okay. I feel like it would be weird if one of my clients recognized me.
Yeah, I just say thank you. They say, I listened to the podcast. Oh, thank you. That's very nice. And then try to move the conversation.
But that's so funny.
You're going to die.
You're in like the most formal setting that you exist in. Like they can't get any of the funny you or any of like right? You just have to go, yes, thank you. Now let's get to your chart. Okay, you know, you're not doing good. You know, it's like, oh my God. Like,
you're not doing good, Jesus.
Well, it's very common for patients to look up their doctors on the internet.
I heard, I found that out recently. I was one of the other, like one of the, what do you call them, child care counselors at the group home where I work, texted me. It was like, the girls found your Instagram, by the way. And I was like, oh no, I didn't even think about what to do. I mean, luckily my Instagram is all just like nerdy science stuff and pictures of my dog. And I show them pictures of my dog already. But they were like, are you famous? And I was like, no, I'm not famous.
Yeah, if you have to ask, the answer is no.
Yeah. Why do you have to be Instagram
I have to be cool with anything my patients can find online. That's just the reality if you're a professional. Mm-hmm. But also, I think, you know, it filters people out a little bit, and I'm kind of okay with that. You know, if someone's not going to see me because of articles I've written for science-based medicine, you know, that's probably not a horrible thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Then you might not be the doctor they want.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Kara.
Yes.
You haven't done a What's the Word in a while.
I haven't. And a word came to mind as I was speaking with a friend, because it is a very common word that I think a lot of people have come across. But like he had said, I never thought to look up what it meant. And I don't think I ever actually knew. So the word is carapace. Have you guys heard this word before?
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, carapace.
Good word.
It's a great word. Catapace. Also, it has my name in it.
It's your middle name, too. Carapace. Yeah. Santa Maria.
Pace is my middle name.
It is now.
It's not Louise anymore.
Oh, wow. Learned something new
every
show.
You guys didn't know it was Louise?
I thought it was Santa.
I knew it was Louise.
No, my last name's Santa Maria.
Kara, I know everything about you because you gave me all your travel information.
Oh, yeah. Yes. No, that's always the joke, you guys, is that my name is very Italian when you just say my first and last name. Cara Santa Maria, right? It means dear mother of God.
But dear mother of God.
I love that.
But then it becomes very Southern when it's my first and middle name. Kara Louise, get down here.
Kara Louise.
Kara Louise.
You're ambidextrous.
Yeah, look at that. Okay, so a carapace. This is the kind of covering, the shell, the shield, whatever you want to call it, that's bony or sometimes made of chitin, that covers usually the dorsal or the back part of an animal. Oftentimes it's like an arachnid or a crustacean, but I think more commonly the way that I usually use the word is referring to a turtle shell.
Yeah.
That's a carapace, is a turtle shell. This is like a fancy way to say turtle shell. Like, ooh, look at that turtle's carapace. And then you can sound super smart when you see a turtle in the wild. Do you guys know what the belly portion is? The underside?
Yes. Wait, give me a second. Brain is searching. Brain is searching.
Meep.
Son of a bitch. Last week I heard this. What is that? I looked it up.
It's the undercarriage. It's the oil
You're
pan.
Never gonna guess
it's
it.
The, come on, Bob.
It's the belly bone.
Phalostrum.
You're so close. It's the plastron.
Yes. All right. I was close. I feel good.
Yeah. The plastron. Interesting, right? I hadn't heard of that either. I just found it when I was reading about the carapace. I tried to look up the etymology, and it's a bit like nobody knows. We know that the word carapace is French. We know that it came from Spanish and Portuguese, carapacho or carapaza, but we don't know where it came from before that. Some people might think, some people think it might have been Latin. Some people think it might have been Greek, that the root words actually are the same words for like a cape. In Latin, it's the same root as cape, but in Greek, it's the same root as beetle. And so nobody really knows where it came from.
Both could work.
Yeah, both could totally work. So this is that kind of like backward etymology, figure it out of out-ishness, trying to make up a word as I go. But we do know that more recently it was borrowed from the French, which was borrowed from the Portuguese. And there's even a Catalan, carapaça. So they all sound kind of similar. Carapace, carapace, carapaça. Yep.
Yep.
Carapace.
Cool. I think it's, you know, it has to be the dorsal section though in order for, it's not usually, I think it always is, right?
Yeah, it has to be the dorsal section.
Which is the back, basically the
which
top.
Is the back. But I do think that in some, I don't want to say always because I fear that there's a handful of animals where it goes all the way around and it's one piece.
Well, it could be, but I think it has to at least cover the back. It could cover
it
all
has
the way
to
around.
Cover the back, yes. Yeah. If it's segmented, it has to be the back piece. But I think sometimes there are animals where it goes all the way around.
And it's also the headpiece too, right? So if you're like a crustacean or an insect, it's not your thorax, it's the headpiece. It's the exoskeleton on the back of the head, basically.
Well, it's usually below the head. Like I guess it depends on the organism, but like if you look at a picture of a lobster's carapace, it's down over its shoulders.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But okay, but it's the one in the front. It's not their tail.
Yes, yes, good point. Yeah, it's more thoracic than abdominal. It's like up high across their shoulders, yeah. kind of.
But on like on a spider, it is their head.
Mm-hmm. And on a crab, it's just the whole body.
Yeah.
And a turtle.
Well, so. Turtles, and the interesting, in turtles, it's their ribs. Their rib cage is the carapace.
Isn't it funny? The shell, yeah, has
I love that.
The ribs Evolution are part of awesome. The shell. It's really cool. Yeah. yeah. Carapace is a really interesting anatomical feature when you actually look at, if you've ever had the opportunity to look at a turtle skeleton, they're really fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Turtles are amazing.
Mm-hmm. So Spider-Man in Endgame, you know that little techno backpacky thing with the legs?
Yeah,
that he
yeah,
has?
Of course.
Can I do not.
Carapace?
You will have to tell me.
It See, basically that... looks like somebody put a giant crab on his back with the claws coming around, wrapping around his body so he could use them.
But it's a part of him. It's not something he wears?
No, yeah, he wears it. Yeah, it's part of his
suit.
Part of his
exo.
I mean, you might be able to call it a carapace, but I think it has to be a part of you to really be a true carapace. It's like a carapace piece. It's a carapace.
All right. We got some cool news items for you this week. We're going to start with Jay. You're going to give us an update on the Hyperloop.
Hyper.
Okay. So in case you didn't know, because maybe everyone listening doesn't know what a Hyperloop is, it could be something that Bob, you know, something with physics that Bob's into. A Hyperloop is actually...
I do think it involves physics.
It does, but, you know, it's not like, you know, this is something that you could actually see with your eyes. It isn't like, you know, an invisible force or a black hole situation. So I want you to think of it as a giant hamster tube that, like, something a car size or bigger could fit in. And they suck the air out of it, or not all of it, but they suck a lot of the air out of the tube. And what this does is it allows whatever vehicle is traveling through the tube to have a lot less wind resistance, right? And that's pretty much it. There's lots of ways it could manifest itself or ways that it could be designed, but that's the concept that you're just sending passengers in a vehicle that's traveling through a tube that is mostly void of air.
Is it like the tubes at the old bank?
Yes, exactly. So when you ever were in like a Costco or, you know, one of those places, you could see that they used to pass money through one of those vacuum tubes. That essentially is it. The tube is getting sucked along because there's negative air pressure on the other side. I think in this instance, though, it's not really sucking the vehicle through. There just is a lower air pressure in the tube, and the vehicle gets propelled by what? It could be magnets
Something
or whatever.
Something else, yeah.
Something else.
That's right.
And it could travel really fast because there just isn't wind getting in the way. And, you know, I'd have to say right now, on the surface, before digging into the details, a Hyperloop could seem like a really cool idea. You know, it could allow passengers to move really fast. I would think that, you know, at its upper limit, you know, the speed could be pretty extreme. Like, I'll be talking about what the speeds are now, but, you know, they could be eventually very fast. But is it really a good thing? You know, is it worth spending the money to fully deploy the infrastructure to build Hyperloops when you compare it to what we have today? And what is it actually promising to do today? Or even, like, what could it do in 10 years? And the question is, I'll tell you right now, I have a very large skeptical flag up in the air about Hyperloops, even though I think they're cool and I'd love to see the technology developed if it pans out. It would be a lot of fun. And I would like to travel faster, but the details, man. So let's get into the details. So as an example, driving your typical car, I know Bob knows this, most of the fuel you use is spent on what?
Acceleration.
Drag.
Dealing with drag and friction.
Yeah.
Yep. Dealing mostly with drag. So I have some cool statistics here for you. It's actually called wake drag, by the way. It's not that the air is passing over the car, because we have cars that are very aerodynamic today. It's when the air gets caught up and makes like little
vortices
or eddies or whatever. That's called wake drag, and that's really where you're losing it, because at different speeds, the car will do different types of things with the air. You know, at
eddies,
right?
The space-time continuum.
And the faster you go, the less efficient most vehicles or all vehicles become. So I'll give you a quick chart. At 60 miles per hour, your car is 3% less efficient than 55 miles per hour. At 65, it goes down to minus 8%. At 70, it goes down to minus 17. At 75, it goes down to minus 23. At 80, it goes down to minus 28. So as you go faster, your vehicle becomes less fuel efficient. So there actually is a good reason to drive 55. How about that? A Hyperloop wouldn't really deal with this diminishing return thing that I just told you about. And it also wouldn't have to deal with a few other things. heavy traffic issues, pedestrians, or bad weather are great examples of lots of nasty things that we have to deal with roads, you know, especially if a tornado comes and rips your neighborhood apart, you don't have to deal with that. So new technology like this, of course, it comes with a lot of questions and concerns. And one of the biggest ones is, where should the tubes exist, right? So they're going to build it. Let's say they decide they're going to build a hypertube. So what do? Do you build it above ground or do you build it below ground? This is a huge question right out of the gate, because the cost differential between those two scenarios is dramatic. So above ground, it would be less expensive than digging tunnels. But then you have to think about like things like real estate. Okay, where's it going to go? You know, this is a massive expense. Let's say you wanted a Hyperloop in New York City. How could you possibly build one of these in a city like New York City? Like on what property? And what, you know, would you put it just around the exterior? You know, and even still, where would it go specifically? Would it be up in the air? You know, that could be dangerous. You know, that could have an impact in ways that we haven't thought of. And let's say that you didn't have to worry about it. Let's say you were using it like a subway where it was going outside of a city. Well, you'd have to worry about the existing roadways and wildlife as an example, because you can't just, you know, again, you can't just build structures without having an impact on the environment. It would also need to be maintained and protected from the elements, which adds some costs. And another concern, which is pretty scary, is terrorism, right? Now, imagine people are traveling at 500 miles an hour in a Hyperloop, and all of a sudden somebody blows up a part of it and all that air rushes in. Now, you're going 500 miles an hour and suddenly the air pressure comes back. You're not in good shape.
Basically, you hit a wall.
Now, you know, you focus on the underground Hyperloop. So what do you got to do? Well, okay, so building tunnels would solve a lot of the above ground issues, of course. You know, they wouldn't take up the same amount of real estate. They could easily go under cities. They could easily get around obstacles like rivers and big roads and highways. The problem is, once you start adding up the cost of digging tunnels, man, this could make the price skyrocket like nobody's business. And it might quickly outstrip the benefit that you're getting, because digging holes is not cheap. You need special machinery. And this machinery, if you've ever seen them dig, you know, a legit hole underground with those round machines that turn around, they have to precisely, you know, get two different ones from two different directions to match up and all. This is big business, massively expensive type of work. So either way, building a Hyperloop means that an incredible amount of red tape has to be dealt with. There's going to be issues revolving around land usage and right of way and environmental impact, et cetera, right? So we have two major developers today. We have Elon Musk's Boring Company, and I mean boring as in like boring a hole. That's the name of the company. And Virgin Hyperloop One. There are some big differences between the technology that they're working on. So Virgin System actually has a promising test track built in the Nevada desert right now. You can see videos of this online if you go take a look. They've done some recent tests, and they have actually achieved speeds of up to 240 miles per hour. Inside of their hypertest loop, which is pretty cool.
But I do want to point out, Jay, that was with in that system, it's like a subway car, you know, going down. But yeah, there was no people inside, so no one has actually rode that test track yet.
Yeah. Now, of course, the car would have to be airtight, right? Of course. And that's, you know, whatever technology that they're going to have to develop to do that. And they only reached 240 miles per hour because they were saying, look, it was just the shortness of the track. They've only got a quarter mile track. So they have to spin the thing up and then have it hit this max speed, then quickly spin it down because the track is ending. So now this really was ridiculous. I watched the video and they're showing some engineers who were working on the project and they're like, we could get this system going as soon as 2023. No, you can't. I'm 100% sure that no one is going to be riding in a Hyperloop by 2023, not in 3.5 years. There's way too much stuff that hasn't been achieved yet and red tape that hasn't been gotten through yet. That's way too quick. You know, 10 years sounds a lot more reasonable to me. If there was a huge amount of money and political will behind it, maybe shorter than that, but nobody's going to be riding in them that soon. But it is pretty cool to take a look at. So I recommend looking at that video. Now, Elon Musk and his company, their technology was originally conceptualized to basically be like a road vehicle that goes on a sled, right? So it drives up on let's just say it's this big metal sled, and they're using magnets to levitate it and propel it, kind of like the maglev train, you know, similar type of idea there. And this was a pretty cool idea, and everyone that seemed very excited about it, but they scrapped it because, you know what, it didn't work well. They tried to use it. I saw a video of it, and they got the sled up to 50 miles per hour, and it was a very bumpy, scary looking ride. So the Boring Company ended up paving over the magnetic track. And they just had a car drive on a tunnel, a paved tunnel, and you know, that was dug in the ground. And you know what? I wasn't impressed. First of all, you know, the tunnel was tight. The car gets in there and somebody's steering this in the tunnel. I mean, you can't let people do that. If you get into a car accident inside this little tunnel, the clear out procedure must be ridiculous, you know?
Why would you even need to? It's only going one direction, one way. Why wouldn't it just be on a regular track then?
I know, Kara. I didn't understand. Yeah,
why would you have to drive it?
Yeah. I know.
It's weird.
I'm agreeing with you. In the video, if you realize the person's driving the car in the tunnels, it all of a sudden gets a little weird. Mm-hmm. It's just an underground roadway. Now, Steve, I got to ask you a question. In that solution, did you read anything that said that they were still lowering the air pressure to make it work better?
Yeah, I think that's still the idea. So you have decreased wind resistance and you have a dedicated road, but you're otherwise just driving on a paved road in a tunnel.
Is it me though? Like, that sounds ridiculous because it's one thing to use their vehicles, like to use the company or whatever, you know, political entity is going to be in charge of it. But like, they're going to maintain the air pressure and you can't just let some person put their vehicle in there. Like, how do you know it's going to be? You know, I know that they're not going to just let a regular car go in, but even if it is a car that was rated to be adequate for air pressure situations, which none exist today, as far as I know, how do you know it's working? It's dangerous.
It's not just that. That's ridiculous because there's no scale. Like, you're building a multi-million, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars project for a car?
Yeah.
No, it needs to be to move thousands of people.
Yeah, I agree.
Otherwise, what's the point? And when it comes down to it, like, there is a problem that people are trying to solve over here on the West Coast, which is how do we get from LA to San Francisco fast, really fast? We don't have an option for that.
That's definitely one, you know, a hyperloop between San Francisco and LA is definitely on the short list. But Jay, here's the question, right? What is the niche for a hyperloop? What is the travel problem it's going to augment or solve?
Well, okay. I mean, I can answer that. It can't compete with airlines because right now the airlines have an immense infrastructure. One airplane can fly to another airport very easily, you know, the way that they organize flights and all that stuff. It can't compete. It's too fast. It's too ingrained in society and it's already there, you know? Like, the Hyperloop would need this massive billion-dollar infrastructure to start bopping around. And for long hauls, it just doesn't seem to work. Now, I agree. Like, this L.A. to San Francisco thing, that could do it. It could be a really good choice if they could get the technology squared. It seems to be the right distance. It seems like if they let the vehicles be big enough to fit, you know, 20 people in a car or 100 people in a car – you know, that when I say car, I mean whatever vehicle they end up putting in there, whatever cool like monorail type job they got going on. That'd be cool.
But they also have to solve the problem of the grapevine. Like, there's too many mountains in the way. This has been a big problem from the beginning. Like, it's not an easy straight shot to go from LA to San Francisco.
Well, it seems like they got to cut through the ground, you know? I mean, I don't know how hard it is to cut through that particular ground.
I know that lots of papers have been written about this specific problem, the grapevine problem. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they built the tunnel. They should be able to build, you know, a tube.
Yeah, but the problem is, Steve, it's a far distance.
It's far.
The speed here.
It's not that far.
If you want this thing to ever get up to, like, you know, airline speeds, 500 miles an hour and up, it can't take turns. You know, it's not going to be, they've got to worry about that big time. And real quick, I don't want to lose this thought. Another thing that Elon Musk did was he wrote a white paper back in 2013 about the Hyperloop technology, the concept behind it and everything. And he made it open source to the public, which was great because, you know, I don't want to fanboy hard on Elon Musk. I don't know him personally, right? I don't know the guy. I just like the way he's rolling right now. I like the impact that he's having on society. To me, it's positive. You know, I know there's a lot of people out there that don't like him, but I mean, you can't take away from the cool things that he's helped develop. He really does want competition. Like, he wants other companies to put the money into all of these new technologies that are happening, including the Hyperloop. That's why he gave away a lot of free information with his white paper. So I give him some props for that. So both of these companies seem to be in the lead with Hyperloop technology, but, you know, they're not there yet. And let's face it. Let's say the technology did exist. The question again is, let's put it right down on the line here. Is it going to be worth the expense to implement it? And would we gain anything? Would there be an actual net gain? I'll give you this one answer that I didn't read anywhere. I came up with this, but I think it's important. I'd say that in the long term, it might end up being better if we can develop the technology, because you could power the Hyperloop with renewable energy. And you can't do that with, you can't power airplanes with electricity yet. And that might be something, there might be something to it because jets contribute enormously to global pollution. The, you know, I know the jet infrastructure is already in place and airports are everywhere. And again, you can't reroute a Hyperloop. You can't throw airplanes at a problem when it comes to, you know, the Hyperloop is a very rigid thing, you know. But I still think having something that could be powered by renewable energy might be the way we move people in the future. Maybe we move away from air travel and move more into Hyperloops. I don't know.
All right, let me tell you my guess. And this is very hard to predict future technology. If I had to guess, I would say we're never going to see a Hyperloop in the foreseeable future. Not in the US. You know, there may be, like, I know Dubai's investing in it, and maybe, who knows, maybe something like that. Somebody wants to throw a ton of money at it just for the novelty of it.
Sure, why would we do that? We don't even have bullet trains for
Yeah, that's my point. So, first of all, it's never, in my opinion, it's never going to replace air travel. Air travel is, you just need two airports. You know what I mean? You don't need any infrastructure in between them. And I don't think we're going to get the Hyperloop up to the speed of current jets. And if we did, by the time we did that, we're going to have supersonic jet passenger jets. I think the probability of having that is a lot greater for much less infrastructure cost. I just don't see this ever competing with air travel. So really the only possibility is that it's going to compete with train travel on the medium distance, like the LA to San Francisco, New York to DC, that kind of thing, like the Eastern Corridor. And there, I think the reason we're never going to see it in one word is maglev. Why would we do this when we don't even have a maglev? Right now, the fastest maglev in service can travel at 267 miles per hour.
That's
and there
incredible.
Are maglevs on test tracks that have gotten up to 374 miles per hour.
Whoa.
So with just maglev technology, again, it's using magnets to levitate the train. You can, we're approaching 400 miles per hour. And yes, that needs infrastructure. It needs a track, which is still a lot easier than a tube in terms of infrastructure. So why would we go all the way to a Hyperloop when we don't even have a maglev? The current maglevs are faster than the current Hyperloops. And I think that then they're plenty fast for these medium city distances. They require, it's a proven technology with less infrastructure. And I think, you know, there are logistical and legal reasons why it's difficult to lay down that infrastructure in the US. And the same reasons that we don't have a maglev in the US, we're not going to have a Hyperloop in the US. And for countries where you can have maglevs, they do. And I don't think the speed advantage of the Hyperloop is going to be enough anytime soon to justify the increased infrastructure cost. Right? Why would you build a 500 mile an hour Hyperloop when you could build a 400 mile an hour maglev much cheaper? The cost benefit is not there. So for those reasons, I just don't see where it's going to fit in, and why would we ever go there until you can get to the point where it would make economic sense, you know, to build this massive infrastructure. I don't see it happening. But it's just one of those things. It's a sexy technology that when you think about it in the real world, they just don't see a place for it.
Yeah, it sounds so cool. But then you think, imagine building an underground tube from New York to DC. What a job. That's like like geoengineering almost. That's insane to think about. It's such a long tube under the ground. I mean, for
remember
such
the
a
big
distance.
Dig in Boston?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That took 10 years, 20 something billion dollars to accomplish. And that was just getting a tunnel built in Boston.
Now, you know, once you have it, though, it would be a great piece of infrastructure.
Right? It would be epic.
All right, Bob, here's another technology that I'm dubious about, but I think there's some potential. Okay, it's like there's potential here, but who knows what's going to actually happen? Smart clothing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this wearable technology. It's been in the news lately more than it has in the past, for sure. So two companies. I found two separate news items that are claiming serious inroads in the creation of clothing with integrated electronics that is also still washable and stretchable and comfortable and not, you know, and not clunky and annoying. That's their goal anyway. So are these real advances finally, or is it more sci-fi fluff? You know, I'm really hoping that this could be finally, like the start of something like this, where there's this comfortable clothing with embedded electronics. But to me, it's like a lesser version of jetpacks and flying cars, right? You know, we've thought about it since we were kids, and we're surprised it's not here already, but we're totally skeptical when anybody says that they've had a breakthrough. It's like, really? Whatever. The show, you know, talk to me when people are wearing this stuff, because you see it a lot, and it's like, we can't even get a serious shirt with heating elements that you could wash. I mean, how simple must that, you know, can that be? And it's still not, why doesn't everybody own a shirt that you just put a little battery to it and bam, you can go out in 10 degree weather and you don't even need a coat. We don't even have that yet. So
that reminds me really quickly. That reminds me of a Jetsons cartoon episode where
he's testing
this like super armor. Yep. Clothing thing, and then it gets destroyed in the washing machine.
Yep.
That's how that will happen, yes.
Well, that said, though, I think we may potentially be entering a time here when all the elements needed to create this real smart clothing might be finally coming together. Hard to, you know, be really confident, but, I mean, look at Gartner forecast. They recently said that shipments of wearable devices, just generic wearable devices this year, will reach 225 million. That's up almost 26% from 2018. That's a huge, huge leap. They also, they looked at specifically smart clothing itself, and they're predicting an increase from 4.1 million shipments in 2017 to 19.9, just under 20 million shipments by 2022. So they're seeing some good things coming with wearables, generally, but also smart clothing specifically. So let's look at the first company is called Pareta. It's a UK startup called Pareta. They claim to have developed a technology that can embed electronic systems, or what they'll say, conductive patterns, right onto the textile. And it's integrated at the fiber level, so the fabric doesn't lose any of its desirable properties. You know, how breathable it is and how it moves and how it stretches. You don't lose any of that because it's actually part of the fibers. And they claim that this could be done at any point in the creation, really. You could do it on, you know, you could integrate this stuff onto a finished garment, or at the level of like when it's like on these huge rolls that all the patterns are cut from at a mass scale. So at one end of the spectrum, you could have an Etsy shop, a private little Etsy shop that buys these garments and then somehow is doing this themselves of integrating the electronics, or it could be just a mass market and reach, you know, many millions of people. That's part of the appeal. And they say they could do this on knitted textiles, woven, non-woven, natural, synthetic. So it seems like you could put it on most any type of textile that's out there. And I found this quote from the Pareta news release. Wearable technology is on the cusp of a major transformation. Wearable products are evolving from rigid devices such as smartwatches and wristbands towards genuinely wearable smart garments based on electronic textiles or e-textiles. So you may be hearing more about e-textiles from Pareta in the future. The other company was DuPont. They have a DuPont Advanced Materials that has been working with on these things and with some other companies. And the product line, I think they refer to it, is called DuPont Intexar. So their idea is they have these unique stretchable inks and films. So that's kind of what they've been focusing on, these special inks and films that could be added to the textiles to, again, create a comfortable, durable, and washable smart clothing. I think they're saying that this thing can survive 100 wash cycles, which is pretty good. I don't know what the average, you know, number of wash cycles a typical piece of clothing goes through. I would think it would be more than 100, but that's pretty damn good, I think, if you have electronics embedded and you can wash it 100 times. So they have things like flexible sensors that can be used for things like biomedical applications. They even have printed flexible batteries and photovoltaic, so pretty slick. One thing that they developed piqued my interest back to the clothes that actually heat up that you could, you know, you could just wear outside instead of having a bulky jacket. They call it Intexar Heat. And let's see this. So I'm pulling some of this from their website. It consists of a thin layer of carbon resistors interconnected by an underlying layer of silver electrodes printed on a stretchable thermoplastic polyurethane laminate. So then they say that when powered, I'm not sure what that means. Would you just have like a 9-volt battery that you would plug this into? What kind of, you know, would it be photovoltaics? I'm not sure how it would be powered. But they said that when powered, it would create a comfortable warmth that doesn't rely on cables, thick wires or big batteries and can stand up to very cold environments. So that's cool. That's something that I've wanted for literally decades. Like, where is this stuff? I know they have it out there, but you don't see it very often. I don't see it very often. And it does have bulky cables and batteries and things. It's not very comfortable. It doesn't seem to me. So DuPont said recently about this, Intexar materials also can enable biometric monitoring in smart clothing. Pulse rate, respiratory rate, muscle activity, and form awareness are all measurable using sensors and conductive pathways built from Intexar. So they've really been focusing on this. Specifically, they've been developing a lot of this technology with a wearable market specifically in mind. Some of the analysts are saying that this can work if you consider that the new generation, like I said, the new generation of flexible sensors and batteries have been made with wearables in mind. However, they say that there's still some big challenges ahead in terms of, you know, how you're going to put it all together and interconnect everything. Apparently, that's still a bit of a problem, at least to some of these analysts' point of view. I think we'll eventually crack this nut, probably in dramatic ways eventually. And these latest advancements that I'm reading about could be the beginning of some sort of mass adoption of these smart textiles. But as usual, in terms of how they're going to be used, what's going to be popular with people, you really can't predict that. You can't know that really until you're in the mix and you see, you know, people really experience it and see what kind of applications they're willing to shell out some good money for. But within like 10 to 20 years, I think for sure we're going to see some very interesting applications of this.
The tech may be ready in that time, but I'm still not hearing a killer app though.
Yeah.
Okay, it'll make you warm. All right, that's fine. Okay, great. If you're in a really cold environment, you basically want a heating blanket for a shirt. Okay. But other than that, why would I care? Why would I want electronics in my clothing?
Well, they've got things for infants. I mean, if I had an infant and they've got some of these textiles even now that can monitor things like heart, you know, respiration and heart rate on your baby, that would be
it's really got to be safe then, you know.
Right.
You
gotta put that stuff in his mouth.
Well, if it's being powered by a 9-volt, what's it going to do to a baby?
I didn't see too much on exactly how these would be powered. I was just riffing on the 9-volt thing. I'm sure they probably wouldn't even use a specific 9-volt battery. But, I mean, some of them were talking about integrating photovoltaics. So I don't know how the power sources would work on this. I mean, sure, some of them would be mechanical, just from like a still suit from Dune, where your actual movement could help power it. I'm sure they can go in that direction too. But it's a matter of, you know, how, you know, when is this going to happen? Still, it's kind of hard to say how popular it's going to be. But eventually, I think there'll be some specific niches that people will love. But who's, you know, like I said, who's to say what that will be?
Yeah.
What did you guys think, though, too? Like, I get the idea they want to integrate it with clothes that would need to be washed. But, you know, especially for the thing that heats you up, it could be like a parka or something that you really don't need to wash that often.
Right.
Yeah. Like, an outer clothing that you wouldn't be washing on a regular basis. Not your underwear.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Ooh, it's getting awfully warm in here.
Although it might be more effective as underwear.
It could
right?
be.
Right.
Yeah.
But that has limitations. Ooh.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Bob. All right, Evan, this is an interesting piece in the conversation about the dangers of misreporting medical science news. That's a topic we cover a lot.
We do cover it a lot, and good thing other people are covering it as well. Did you hear about 3D printed human organs in the news recently? Mm-hmm. Well, you misheard. Well, let's just put it this way. A lot of that reporting has been incorrect.
And I'm shocked.
We're not at all shocked at that. Need a new heart? First step, turn on your 3D printer. No, not exactly. Cathal O'Connell, he's from Melbourne, Australia. He's a researcher in 3D bioprinting. And he has a background in physics and nanoscience. He works with surgeons, cool. engineers, and biologists to develop ways to print 3D tissues using living cells. And we've talked about that before on the show. But his particular article here is talking about the misreporting of science, in which it's, and we've talked about this, it's unethical a lot of the times, and it can be potentially dangerous. And he writes about it in relationship to his particular field of expertise. Because he got bombarded last week on his social media pages with headlines such as the first 3D printed heart using a patient's own cells. And they showed a video, a real nicely put together video of a healthy looking heart apparently materializing inside a vat of pinkish liquid.
Right.
Yeah. And he actually went and looked at how much exposure this particular piece got, and he said that he counted it to 3.8 million followers using on Twitter, and it was viewed over 3 million times off the Facebook page. So it's tons of exposure, but it is terribly inaccurate. Now, in the original scientific paper, he said, you got it. It's what we talk about again. We go back to the original scientific paper. And he said, if you go back to the paper, you realize that what actually happened was this. Israeli scientists described how they built upon their own work earlier regarding bio-inks, which are printable materials in cells, to create 3D structures in the laboratory. And their main focus was to print a square patch of heart cells, not to actually 3D print a heart, a working organ. You're actually just making a structure, and then the scientists are using the bio ink to create these little patches for blood vessels using this ink. So the team printed the cells into a thumbnail-sized heart shape, so a little tiny thing, right? The text of the original paper clearly stated that the printed heart-shaped structure was not a real heart. But that got by so many people out there, and before you knew it, 6 million or more people think that an actual heart was printed. He says this is not uncommon, unfortunately. He gave examples, such as a couple years ago, Wake Forest University. They had to issue a clarification notice following a report that one of their scientists had printed a human kidney live on stage. What that scientist had actually done was printed a model of a human kidney on stage. It wasn't the actual human kidney. And then also another one, a 14-year-old boy had become the first human patient to be implanted with a 3D printed nose. No, it wasn't a 3D printed nose. They used the 3D printing to create the shape of the nose, just like a model of the nose, essentially, as a template to help the surgeon do the work that they had to do. So he said this is, you know, a real big problem, and it's the responsibility of scientists such as himself, also, of course, for journalists and anyone else passing on what's ultimately medical information to the consumer. They have to be much more responsible when it comes to these kinds of reports, especially when it has to do with cutting-edge technology. People have a very high level of enthusiasm when it comes to new breakthrough technology. And there's a big excitement about it. There's this rush to say, oh my gosh, this is the latest, greatest thing. And how can I, you know, and he winds up getting phone calls from people at the hospital where he works and other places saying, where can I get in on this latest research I heard about? And he has to, unfortunately, kind of bring them down from those high expectations, say, by the way, these are only models, they're at experimental stage, no human trials, there's nothing like that. So he's constantly finding himself correcting people on this particular aspect of science reporting.
Yeah, I have to believe those journalists know exactly what they're doing. You know what I mean? They just don't care. Like, if you make that level of mistake, it's not like the journalists who reported or showed an image of like a complete heart appearing in a vat that they had to create somehow because it's not real, right? It's not like they didn't know that was total BS.
He also speaks in his paper about the pressure there is on these journalists and other people to promote, to do a sales pitch effectively. And in some cases, the actual creators or developers of these technologies sometimes get caught up in the hype as well. It's because they're trying to bring up, not, you know, obviously the awareness, but it comes down to money. They want more money for research so they can continue to do the work that they need to do. And some sensationalism has to creep almost naturally, in a sense, into these particular pieces of reporting. Otherwise, they don't feel that they're not going to get the attention that it would otherwise receive. So it's kind of a catch-22 in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's effective, right? I mean, we're all loving to see that latest and greatest awesome achievement, but it's massively deceptive, obviously. Like, you can't pretend that you printed a human heart. Like that's, like, I agree with Steve. Like, I don't think anyone was confused about what they were doing there.
Well, I feel like a lot of times what ends up happening is that the article itself will break down all of these issues, but the headline and maybe the lead will open, will have like an open-ended, like, did they, blah, 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 or they'll use vague language in order, or sometimes, yeah, the headline will just be straight up not true.
Yeah.
And if you actually take the time to read the article, a fair amount of times the science writer actually did a like halfway decent job parsing everything,
right?
But the way to get you in was disingenuous, and unfortunately, most science writers don't write their own headlines.
Yeah, there's many points of failure.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot. Exactly, there's a lot of points of failure from our view. Maybe success from the view of somebody who's getting a lot of clicks, and that's the other real difficult thing. It's the way that we monetize these things.
Yeah, but I think the point here, it's all despicable, but the point here is when it's dealing with medical issues, there's this other ethical layer where patients are actually reading this, and this is affecting their interaction with the healthcare system. And, you know, this is like doctors now have to spend their time, and I know because I do this all the time, having to correct misinformation that patients gleaned from popular reporting.
You but know, isn't that also a problem even with like really well-vetted medical information? Like,
yeah, it's bad
isn't
enough.
Isn't WebMD just as difficult for you as a doctor?
It's not just as difficult. It's bad enough when the reporting is good and just dealing with the layer of misinterpretation of hopeful, often like just people are just looking for some hope, you know, and they read something that's maybe a little hyped or they interpret it in a way that's, oh, yeah, can I get stem cells to treat my whatever? It's like,
yes.
Not this decade, you know. Yeah.
Talked about it last week, stem cells.
Yeah, right? No, I got to be the buzzkill. But it's worse when it's like actively deceptive.
Of course, it's
a lot worse, you know.
But that's
so you just
also,
can't compare the two.
I mean, that's an ethical problem across the board. That's unethical in the medical field. That's unethical in journalism, too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, very quickly, some sad news, but... You know, in all honesty, it's not that sad in that you guys know Murray Gell-Mann.
Quarks, baby.
Yep. He passed away this week, but he was 89 years old.
Yeah.
Okay.
So a life well lived.
He had a life well lived. Yeah. He lived to a ripe old age. He died at home. You know, it's not sad in that no one's immortal, but it is a passing of, you know, a great scientist, a great man. By all accounts, he was a great guy, not just a great scientist. So as Bob blurted out there, Murray Gell-Mann is a physicist. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1969, and he won it for, I'll read the Nobel announcement. He won it for his contributions and discoveries concerning the classification of elementary particles and to their interactions. So Gell-Mann was, you know, he was instrumental in assembling the standard model of particle physics. And he was apparently the guy who came up with this notion of quarks. So I think it was independently thought of by somebody else in around the same time. But he had the idea that, hey, we could maybe explain all of these crazy particles that people are discovering if they were made in turn by a deeper level of fundamental particles. Bob, you know where he got the name quarks?
Three quarks from Mr. Mark.
Yeah, from a poem. And then he called them quarks. He also came up with the name gluons.
Yeah, for the force carriers.
Yeah,
they're fascinating just themselves. Yeah, they're absolutely fascinating.
They're the particles that mediate the strong nuclear force, which of course holds the quarks together. And then a lot of people credit him with just giving the whole naming convention of quarks, you know, top, down, charm, all that.
Strange. Charm.
Yeah, that sort of, he set the stage for that whole naming
very whimsical
convention.
Yeah,
very whimsical.
Okay. I'm glad he used easy to understand terminology or names, at least.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't come up with crazy stuff that nobody will ever remember.
By all accounts, just a brilliant physicist and just was able to, you know, again, generate these hypotheses about, hey, how could we explain this really, you know, interesting phenomenon of particle physics? And it just stood the test of time, right? That's why we're talking about him. So we'd like to mark the passing of you know, great scientists. Mm. And Gell-Mann definitely deserves it. Again, one of those people that, you know, should be a household name, you know, like,
right.
I think he's on the level of an Einstein, you know, in terms of his contribution to physics. I mean, we could obviously debate that, but he's, you know, he's pretty much up there. You know, if you came up with the whole idea of quarks and had a huge role to play in the standard model of particle physics, that's Einstein
huge.
Level
that's
contribution.
Huge. That's like,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's like top five type of dude.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. Kara, you're going to finish off the news section with an interesting question about what makes us happy.
Yeah, or I guess why happiness. Yeah, kind of how do we come to those things? There's a couple of interesting articles that some of you may have come across in the news recently. The first one I'm just going to do quick and dirty because there is no source paper for it, or at least not yet. There is a behavioral scientist named Paul Dolan. This was covered in The Guardian, but I think it got picked up in other places, talking about sort of that historically studies were done where spouses, you know, men and women were asked about their level of happiness. And we've seen publications that married people are happier, right? Like we've all seen these publications. It turns out that a lot of the research that was done historically asking married people how happy they were was done with their spouse in the room. Which is, you know, a little bit confounding. Yeah. So apparently when you take the spouse out of the room, the answers change a bit. And what we find is that women tend to be happier when they're not married. Not so the case for men. Sorry. And also women tend to be happier without children. So comparing all the different groups of like married versus unmarried, with children, without children, that women without children and without a spouse tend to be the happiest of the groups.
A bit subjective, Hi-yo. Though.
Of course it's subjective. That's why I said a bit.
Well, you got the happy-o-meter.
The self-reported. Evan.
The happy-o-meter. Exactly. That's that latest, greatest technology I've heard so much about. Where can I buy five of them?
But remember, this is based on self-report data from the actual people. It's not based on some sort of like rating by a psychologist.
I understand that, but one person's happiness, you know, may not be another person's happiness.
Which is why you ask thousands and thousands of people and look for trends in the data. So interesting. Of course, he was citing new research, but he didn't really talk about, like, I can't find the source article. So we'll hold on to that one until we can see more hard data on it. But definitely jumped out on the page to me. I wanted to link it, though, to another article that I came across, which was recently published, talking about whether or not an association existed between mortality and life purpose. So this looked at a really big cohort study of nearly 7,000 adults that are all over the age of 50, a big U.S. health and retirement study. And they were able to pull a bunch of stuff out of this like longitudinal study. And when they started to pull some of the information out of it, because it's the kind of study where there's a massive database with just like tons of questions that were asked. So researchers can write dissertations for decades based on this study. They thought, okay, we want to know whether or not, you know, living for something, feeling like you have a real purpose actually helps you one live longer. And so they looked at the data. They realized that historically, some of the ways that they measured life purpose weren't very good, like single question responses, or there was once a tool that was used that wasn't actually well validated. So after a certain point, the health and retirement study, I think like in the 90s, started asking, or maybe the early 2000s, yes, in 2006, they started asking from a different questionnaire called the Riff and Keys Scale of Psychological Well-Being, which was really well validated. And so they used the data from anybody who was in this study after 2006, after they, you know, got rid of all of the study participants that didn't meet criteria. They ended up with this massive N of, like I said, nearly 7,000 people. And they went through and they started to compare all-time mortality, so just like how soon after doing this, after participation did they die? And also, or sorry, that's all-cause mortality, and also individual illnesses. And they compared those things to people's ratings on this scale, basically, that showed whether or not they felt that their life had a sense of purpose. And they found that for all-cause mortality, there was a high correlation, a significant association between life purpose and mortality, obviously in the negative direction. So people who tended to rate their lives as having more purpose tended to live longer. And they also were able to find that within people who died of heart, circulatory and blood conditions, also digestive tract conditions. And I think there was another one, but they did not find a trend for cancer. So there seemed to be no effect on life purpose and cancer. But really interesting study. They're trying. The discussion's fascinating, too, to read about, because, of course, in the discussion section of almost every study, you have to kind of speculate a little bit. You're like, this is the data. This is what we found. This is what we're actually studying. But why? Right? Like, we don't know. We didn't test why. But based on other literature reviews and meta-analyses and things like that, maybe it has to do with inflammatory factors. Maybe it has to do with things like cytokines, cortisol. You know, there are so many things that they didn't actually test for that could be intermediates, kind of mediating or moderating variables. But they don't know. And so
maybe they
that
just
really
take
does-
better care of themselves.
Could be that, right? That people who feel like they're living for something, and they mention that, of course, are going to be more conscientious about their health and well-being anyway. Maybe they, you know, go to the doctor more often and they eat better and they are probably more risk averse because they're like, I got to stay alive to get my life, my life's work finished or this project, you know, to the next level.
And Kara, my understanding is that there's a pretty consistent signal in the research literature that having a sense of purpose makes you happier.
Yeah,
that
so they
correlates
found
really well.
Absolutely. They found previous studies that showed that. And there were even previous studies that did show some correlation between life purpose and mortality, but there weren't any that were super robust and there weren't any that they felt used a really good validated measure. So they decided to do this and they and this kind of reinforced what the literature was already sort of pointing to, which is that, yeah, having something to live for is incredibly beneficial for mental health, and it actually is correlated with living longer.
Yeah, I think
pretty
that makes
cool.
sense.
Oh, it makes just, perfect sense.
Getting back to the women are happier if they're single thing.
Yes.
No, but I think I wonder how much of that is generational, because I could totally see if you, you know, in the older generation where women do a lot of the domestic work and, you know, the, and don't really have a fulfilling life, they're not out there with, you know, in, well, I'm not, I want to say that they paint with that broader brush, but they are constrained by societal expectations. And you know what I mean? I just think that.
Sure. Did the cult of domesticity make women miserable? Yes. I think that's absolutely true.
So maybe that's what we're just seeing. It's not just that, you know, and I wonder if it's true, like in a more modern context, if a woman, you know, a married woman, because I think they now, why would it be different than men now?
I think there's a couple things to unpack there. And one is that even though it's not as overt as it used to be, I do think that the cult of domesticity stuff exists for sure. We still live in a culture that's patriarchal. We still live in a culture where women are expected to get married by a certain age. Otherwise, they're old maids. Where women are expected to have children by a certain age. Otherwise, what was their purpose in life if not motherhood? Like, there's still a lot of societal pressure from both parents and grandparents, but also just from society as a whole. There's still gender norms and relationships that are heavily based on men making the money and women keeping the home. Although oftentimes women then on top of that still make money. So it's like two breadwinners, yet the women are still supposed to do the laundry and take care of the children and do the cooking and blah, blah. And I'm not saying that's always the case, but I still think it's pretty normative.
Yeah.
They mentioned in this, you know, short write-up, he says that, like, men benefit from marriage because they, quote, calm down. You take fewer risks, you earn more money at work, and you live a little longer. But she, on the other hand, has to put up with that. She actually dies sooner than if she was never married.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the thing we always see, right? Like, when a married woman dies, her husband's like done, like really quickly after. But when a married man dies, a woman usually stays alive a little longer. But apparently if she had never been married, she has an even a longer lifespan. So it's interesting. Like, I think that this really comes down to happiness, though. It comes down to, as Evan said perfectly, it's subjective. Mm-hmm. So if you're the kind of person who seeks, you know, that kind of partnership and who feels like your life is not going to be complete without children, and then you get all of those things that you're working for, you're probably going to be happier. But I think if you're the kind of person who's maybe doing it because of the societal pressures, or you think it's what you want because it's the path that's always been laid out for you, or, you know, you think it's what you want because it's you're getting pressure by your partner or whatever the case may be, which I think through all of human history was to a large extent the case. It's really hard to decouple those things. Like, a woman's right to choose and a woman's right to do all these things, it may be protected, but that doesn't mean that it's not heavily still influenced societally. So it's very hard to know what is it that I want or what is it that I think I want based on how I was raised or based on all the experiences that I've had.
I mean,
you
it
can't
is,
really decouple that.
It is a good sort of overall measure, like happiness. Is it? Mm-hmm. It's vague in a way, and it's but it is a good marker for, I think, a lot of sub-issues like equality, you know?
Absolutely.
And freedom, so I hope it is changing.
Choice.
I hope.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, Jay.
What?
You know what time it is.
Time to dance.
Time for Who's That Noisy?
All right, last week I played this noisy. What is that?
That's a weird one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's very quiet and very clicky creaky.
Yeah.
That's doing something.
So Steve Wynick writes in, says, hello. The noisy this week was the last sound heard by the Opportunity rover as it died alone on an empty planet.
Oh, my God, I'm so depressed right now.
I know, right? Sad. Talk about a midlife crisis. Yeah, that is wrong, but that is a, you know, in a single sentence, like, you know, my heart sank a little bit. That was written well, my friend. But it was not curiosity. David Ernest Garcia wrote in, hi, Jay, I could be totally off, but the noisy almost sounds like a bamboo forest. Cheers.
Steve, does kind of sound like that.
Yeah, does it? Steve and Carrie, Bob, Evan, you think that sounds like a bamboo forest?
A little bit. The creaking and some every so often snapping.
I like that guess.
Maybe so.
Maybe it's slightly reminiscent in my memory of corn growing, that popping of corn growing, maybe a little. I don't know.
Corn pops when it grows, or are you thinking of it in the microwave?
It's called popcorn.
No, like a cornfield. A cornfield, like when they can grow pretty fast.
You could hear it, yeah.
And you could hear, if there's enough, you can hear like, you know, like just the cracks and stuff of the plants growing.
So someone from the city hearing that for the first time must be a little...
I know.
Like, what is going on?
I'm like, you mean in your microwave?
Yeah. You're talking popcorn, aren't you? All right. So Anders Winstrand is the winner this week. And Anders said, how are you doing, Jay? This week's noisy is what we in Sweden call a chader or chader, pronounced like shatter with a drawn out A. So it's shatter with a drawn out J. So it's shader. Shader.
It's either shader or shader.
Shader, yeah. Okay.
You or shatter. Yes, rude. Drawn out.
Or William Shatner. Or in English, a capercaillie. Or capercaillie. And he says, I'm sure you can pronounce that correctly. Ha ha. Everybody knows. the noisy is That's the awesome. Male of one of these huge birds in full lek, which is mating mode, around this time of year when they are known to be very aggressive and often attacking people who get too close. Keep up the good work. Listen to it again. I heard that and I'm like, wow, this could be so many different weird things. You know, it has like a cup sound to it almost, like it's the throat echoing, but it didn't sound like an animal to me, which I just
said,
this is it, man. So let me give you a little more information. And this is the info that Jerry Keller sent in when he originally sent me the noisy. He said the Western capercaillie, God, I hate pronouncing words, also known as the wood grouse, heathercock, or just a capercaillie. Chiellie, it's the largest member of the grouse family. The largest known specimen recorded in captivity had weighed 7.2 kilograms or 16 pounds. The species shows extreme sexual dimorphism, with the male twice the size of the female. Found across Eurasia, this ground living forest bird is renowned for its mating display.
I think it's just pronounced capercaillie.
Capercaillie. Capercaillie. Yep, you're right. I don't know. I could be wrong.
I think it's just capercaillie.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know.
But and think about how weird reality is. In some crazy mind, this means, hey, would you like to get it on?
Of course. Turning like, me on. You have no idea. Wow.
That's like, you are so sexy. Okay, so I have a new noisy. The noisy for this week was sent in by a listener named Brendan Flynn. Thank you, Brendan. And check out this noisy. That's a new noisy for those who just joined us. And that only works with a live broadcast, yeah. I think, when you say things like that. So anyway, if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or you want to send me in that cool noise, just like the one you just heard, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, I would like to ask our listeners to please consider leaving us a comment or some type of feedback on iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you are using. We haven't asked that in quite a while. Mm-hmm. And it actually is a good thing to do to help other people find the show.
Yeah, it absolutely helps promote the show.
Just don't write in to tell Jay that it's actually pronounced Capercaley. I looked it up.
That's right. That's right, Capercaley.
That's right, Capercaley.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Bob, who was it that said the best way to be correct is to be technically correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that. I think that's just a meme that's out that's
yeah,
out there.
That's
who knows
technically
who,
correct,
it.
Which is the best way to be correct. All right.
Technically correct.
We're going to do a question, an email that is in that vein. This one comes from Ken Wallace. And Ken writes, "This one has been bugging me since Phil Plait said it. I am an engineer who designs GPS receivers and a big fan. I have to take issue with the statement that some people mistakenly use the term bandwidth instead of throughput. Engineers reserve the term throughput for software and processors. In the case of a communication channel, throughput is akin to the data rate. As the data rate increases, the bandwidth required to transmit that data increases." And then he references Shannon theorem. "Bandwidth is a limited resource, the coin of the realm. Over the air, it is allocated by the FCC, and a cable or fiber, the medium itself, has bandwidth limits. When higher data rates are desired, the question is always, where are you going to get the bandwidth? And is why engineers are focused on bandwidth and not data rates. The FCC has allocated 5G service more bandwidth than 4G, so higher data rates are possible." Okay, so what's he talking about? So he mentioned this on the show, I think, last week about...
Yeah, I asked you guys what throughput means.
Yeah, oh, and there's also, we mentioned, you know, about bandwidth, is often people use bandwidth interchangeable with like how quickly the data is being transferred. Mm-hmm. And we had been corrected previously by Phil Plait on the show about it, which is why he brings up Phil Plait. Okay, I looked it up just to try to square all this away. And it's one of those things that's complicated, but I'm going to try to give you my understanding. Obviously, Ken is correct. The guy knows what he's talking about, but I'm just going to broaden that a little bit. So there's three terms
that
we want to define, right? It's bandwidth, throughput, and data rate.
Okay.
The thing is, bandwidth technically is the amount of frequencies that are available, right? It is the width of the band, right? It is the bandwidth, yeah. Number of frequencies. But he's correct that the maximum data rate or throughput is a function of the bandwidth, but it's not the current or the actual throughput. So bandwidth is the breadth of frequencies that you have available to you, and that determines the maximal, you know, rate at which you can push data through the pipe. So the bandwidth is how big the pipe is, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The throughput is the amount of data actually going through the pipe at any moment.
So that's how much water's in the pipe.
Yeah, and the data rate and throughput are very similar. You know, data rate is like the megabytes per second, like how many megabits per second are going through. So throughput depends not just on the bandwidth, though. It also depends upon the signal-to-noise ratio. So he referred to Shannon, which is, you know, was one of the founders of information theory. But it's actually the Nyquist equation. Nyquist refers to the relationship between bandwidth and the maximum data rate. There's also the Shannon-Hartley equation, which takes into consideration the signal-to-noise ratio. Because the maximum amount of energy of data that you could push through the pipe depends on the bandwidth and the signal-to-noise ratio. The Nyquist equation assumes zero noise. So that's like an idealized situation, which doesn't exist in the real world. So that's interesting, though, because then data companies could tell you about their bandwidth that they're offering you, but that's an idealized situation that you will never experience. You will never get that. Like, they'll say, yeah, we have a bandwidth that allows for, you know, 100 megabits per second, but you're only going to see 60 megabits per second because there's actually noise in the system. It's not an idealized noiseless system.
That's 60 megabits your throughput?
That's your data rate. And then the throughput is the actual amount of data that's going through. But again, data throughput and data rate, you don't have to really, that's a subtle difference. You don't really have to worry about that too much. But
okay.
It's like the data rate is kind of the maximum. So bandwidth is the maximum, the data in an idealized situation. Data rate is your actual maximum data rate, and throughput is the actual amount of data that's going through. Does that make sense?
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those two things sound the same to me. So
They're very similar.
I'm going to pretend they're the same.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry about it. I've read many articles on it. They said these are confusing. There are subtle distinctions. Even people in the industry get it technically incorrect, but that's the things that you want to know about. So if you want to use bandwidth as shorthand for like how much data can we put through the system, it's actually not a bad analogy. Data rate is technically more correct because it takes into consideration the bandwidth plus the signal-to-noise ratio. And there are other things, too, like the quality of the receiver. The better the receiver, the more it's going to be able to accept your data, you know? So that will limit it as well. So there's real-world context that will affect the actual throughput, the actual amount of data that's going through. And then also...
Well, and isn't your throughput also dependent on other people in the system? Or is that just your bandwidth? That's everybody's bandwidth.
That's, you are correct. So there might be 10 people using that pipe. And so their data rate is going to be different because they're sharing the bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's why, like, you have an office and you're like, oh, we have this great, all this massive bandwidth, gigabits per second. But yeah, you have 100 people sharing it. And so their data rate is going to be very, very limited. So 5G. So I asked specifically, all right, but what's the relationship between the frequency, like 5G versus 4G? 5G is a higher frequency. Does that give you more data rate? And the answer is no, but. Mm. Mm-hmm. The amount of data that you can that the signal is carrying does not depend upon the frequency of the signal, but the higher the frequency, the greater the bandwidth the signal can occupy, and so you have to go to higher frequencies in order to utilize greater bandwidth and therefore a higher data rate with any one signal. Does that make sense? So the 5G is allocated more bandwidth, but it could also utilize more bandwidth because it's a higher frequency. So there's an indirect relationship between frequency and how much data you can put through, right? All other things being equal, the frequency in and of itself doesn't change the data rate. Does that make sense?
Sort of, yes.
It does. I mean, I get it. I'm just not sure why would more data be able to go over a higher bandwidth? I mean, a higher frequency, sorry.
Because a higher frequency allows you to use more bandwidth. And the bandwidth is the ultimate limiting factor on how much data you could push through.
So like when people say, I just don't have the bandwidth for this right now. Like that's a good analogy.
It's a reasonable metaphor. It's more of a metaphor. Okay, cool. But yeah, it's a reasonable metaphor. Absolutely.
Oh, sorry. I wasn't technically correct when I said analogy.
Right.
I still won't get cancer by using 5G.
You still won't get cancer. Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's all still true.
Okay.
All right. All right. We squared away on that. Good. Let's go on to a name that logical fallacy. This one comes from Justin from Fort Erie, Ontario. And Justin writes, I run a YouTube channel in which I respond to mostly young earth creationism. Your show and websites are often a great resource for me, and I appreciate all the hard work you guys put in. I'm just wondering if this logical fallacy has a name or if it is encapsulated within another fallacy. I've had several people message me asking questions like, if abiogenesis is so easy that it could happen naturally, why haven't we been able to replicate it with modern science yet? Is this just an extension of the argument from ignorance in that we humans are currently ignorant of the specifics of how something works, therefore it can't possibly happen naturally, have happened naturally, or is there a more specific fallacy that I am unaware of? Thanks for everything you do. What do you guys think about that argument that if abiogenesis can happen in nature, right, if this can happen just through natural forces, why haven't we been able to do it ourselves?
Geez, nuclear fusion happens in the sun naturally. We have a pretty hard time getting it to work here on the planet.
Right.
And protons decay. We got to wait quintillions of millennia. I mean,
yes, there's some sort of logical fallacy that says human beings are all powerful.
Yeah. So what would you call that? What would you call that, Kara? That kind of, it's not technically a logical fallacy, what you said, but
the
it's
human arrogance fallacy. No, well, I don't know. I have to look up my cheat sheet.
I would say that when you're introducing something like that, it's an unstated major premise, right? Mm. That you're, in other words, you're assuming something and taking it as a premise without explicitly stating, this is my premise. And if that unstated major premise turns out to be an unwarranted assumption or just flat out wrong, then your argument is doomed to failure, even if the logic itself is okay. So with this person, when someone makes that argument, they're basically, the unstated major premise, in my opinion, is that if something can happen in nature, then it should be easy or at least achievable to do it with technology, with modern science. And as Evan, you brought up a great example. Well, yeah, there's all kinds of things that happen, like nuclear fusion happens in the sun, but it's really, really technically difficult to do it. Of course, I would say if there's a logical fallacy in there, it's the false analogy, because they're trying to, in the case of Evan's example, you're making an analogy between the conditions that exist within the core of the sun and conditions that we can reproduce on Earth, right? Mm-hmm. In the case of the young Earth creationist argument, the false analogy is the time frame that scientists have to work with and the time frame that evolution or natural forces had to work with. It may have taken millions of years for abiogenesis to occur on Earth. And you're saying, why can't we reproduce this Earth-sized experiment over millions of years in a laboratory? Well, that's why, because this is something that, just the time and scope of the resources that were available for this to happen. There is no analogy to a laboratory, and the fact that we have modern technology doesn't solve those problems. Just like it doesn't solve the tremendous heat and pressure you need to make fusion happen.
Well, and the Miller-Urey experiment was good. Like, it was a solid experiment, right?
Yeah, it got part of the way. It didn't answer a lot of questions, but it just showed the feasibility of one piece of the process.
And, like, a pretty freaking important piece of the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like, amino acids. Like, if we could get there.
Yeah, I mean, there's still major pieces to the puzzle that experiment didn't solve, and we don't want to oversell it. Absolutely. But yes.
He's almost speaking as if it never happened.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, why can't we do this in the lab? It's like, well, we've already done part of it in the lab.
Yeah. Well, that's just denialism. That is the setting the goalpost out of reach of whatever we've currently done. Doesn't matter. Anything we've currently know or any current experiments are never enough, because we just set that. That's like a move. You could say this is a moving goalpost fallacy as well. Just set that bar out of reach. In that, you haven't made life in the lab yet? It's all bullshit then. Well, why? Why is that your criterion? You're reproducing it in a lab? It's not a reasonable criterion, because the conditions that in which it happened in nature are vastly different than anything we have the capability of reproducing in the lab. At best, we can reproduce tiny slices of it, like with the Miller-Urey experiments. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just or like with evolution. Yes, we've observed tiny slices of evolution in the lab. We haven't, observed the kind of evolution that takes millions of years, because it takes millions of years.
Yeah,
so it's just not a reasonable.
And we don't need to observe that to know.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's partly denialism. It's partly moving the goalpost. It's partly a false analogy. It's partly the unstated major premise. It's kind of all working together in that.
And similar to denialism, like looking at this one resource for logical fallacies, informal, again, logical fallacies, they name one called personal, like incredulity, like he's incredulous. Like, just because he doesn't understand it means it's probably not true. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a very common informal logical fallacy.
The argument for personal incredulity. I can't imagine that happening.
Well, exactly.
That's not a limitation on nature.
Therefore.
And let's get real. Whenever somebody makes that kind of argument, it's almost always motivated reasoning, right? Sure. They're just backfilling an argument for something they already want to believe in. That didn't lead them to the conclusion in the first place. They don't say, I don't believe in evolution because I can't imagine it. They have some other reason for doubting evolution, and they're using the lack of the ability to imagine it as just motivated justification for it. You know, because it's an argument. They're just reaching for the available arguments to support their position, not really using logic to arrive at a conclusion. Okay. All right, guys. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Absolutely, Steve.
All right.
Yep.
Yeah, sure.
All right, here we go. Item number one. A new study found that only 54% of teenaged girls given a prescription in the ER for a sexually transmitted disease filled the prescription. Item number two. Scientists have found a method for increasing the maximum speed by which catalysts can increase chemical reactions by 10,000 times. And item number three, a new study finds that applications of commonly used herbicides increase the mutation rate in weeds, making the emergence of resistance more likely. All right, Kara, go first.
New study found only 54% of teenage girls given a prescription in the ER for an STD filled the prescription. Bums me out, but I would think it's probably true. This was a U.S. study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because in the U.S., right, they're not going to have health insurance, or they might be on their parents' health insurance and they might be afraid to use it. They might not have enough money to cover the prescription. I think that if in the ER they actually physically gave them the pills, they'd be more likely to take it. But if they had to then go to a pharmacy to fill it, I could definitely see a lot of girls being afraid to do that. Scientists have found a method for increasing the maximum speed by which catalysts can increase chemical reactions by 10,000 times. Okay. To be clear, the speed has been increased by 10,000 times, not the catalysts are increasing the chemical reactions 10,000 times.
So I don't know what the difference is between those two things is, but so in other words, the amount by which a catalyst can speed up a chemical reaction has a limit. Right. And what these scientists figured out is a way of increasing that limit by 10,000 times.
Okay. I don't know enough about chemistry to know. It just seems like a very big leap. Let me jump to the last one. A new study finds that applications of commonly used herbicides increase the mutation rate in weeds, making the emergence of resistance more likely. Commonly used herbicides. Well, we already know that Roundup does that. Glyphosate. I don't know if it increases the mutation rate, but I do know that it increases the emergence of resistance. I don't know if it's a mutagen itself, but the evolution happens faster because the other things are just dead, so they can't reproduce. So this one's a little tricky. You're saying they're mutagens. New study finds that application of commonly used herbicides increase the mutation rate. They're actual mutagens. I think it's between two and three. 10,000 times seems high. It seems like maybe 1,000 times faster. So I'm going to say that one's the fiction, although that's a gotcha one, and that's probably the science. But I'm going to go with the catalyst being the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right. So this first one here about the teenage girls given a prescription, they're saying that 54% of them who were given a prescription in the ER about an STD did not fill the prescription. It says that they... 54% did fill the prescription.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, only 54% filled.
Yeah, which is, you know, 50, it's almost 50-50 there.
Yeah.
God, when I think it through, I'm like, all right, you're in the ER. They tell you, hey, you got an STD and here's a prescription. You know, hopefully, like, you know, I don't know the difference between them saying it'll get rid of it or this will help. You know, I don't think they're going to give you a prescription in the ER for something that needs therapeutic medication. Like herpes, you don't get rid of. They just give you something to get rid of the symptoms. But I don't know. Either way, like, you just think that most of the people would be like, yeah, I better do something about that. You know, and did they go to the ER for that? That's the question. Was it a secondary thing or did they go into the ER specifically for the STD? Because if they did, you'd think that they would even be doubly likely to get the prescription. So that one just says, I don't know about that. I don't know if I agree with the 54%. You'd think it'd be a lot higher. The one about the chemicals, I have no problem thinking that they found a way to increase a chemical reaction by 10,000 times. I mean, it might seem that might seem like a lot, but it might in the real world might not translate into it being that much faster, I'm guessing. Again, you know, I agree with Kara.
It translates to it being 10,000 times faster.
Yeah, but it might be the difference between a fraction of a second and a second, and you wouldn't really even be able to notice it. You know what I mean? It could be such a short amount of time that you wouldn't really, really notice it. But either way, even still, even if I'm wrong about that, I don't think that them finding something like this is that kooky. I think it just the big number might be because of very short time spans. And then the last one here, a new study finds that applications of commonly used herbicides increased mutation rate.
Comically used herbicides.
Yeah. And, you know, hilarious. And I could see that one being true too, because, you know, the herbicides are going to be attacking certain things, and, you know, other weeds could have mutated to not be as affected, and their survival rate is just enough where they survive and pass on. So I could argue for that one as well. So
it can't all be true.
I know. I think the first one about the ER, 54% of teenage girls, that one's a fake.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, that just sounds so sad that that could even be a possibility. If that's true, that would be terrible. 54, half. Flip a coin. Bob, I won't fill my prescription, huh?
Judge unemotionally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just surprised that you could, you know, oh, I have an STD. Oh, here's some medicine to help me with it. Ah, screw it. Like, wow. Yeah. Why would anybody do that? That's just all right. So
I explained why, but okay.
I remember hearing you talk about it, and I was thinking I should heed Kara's advice.
You were thinking I should listen to these words.
Yes. I did. I did. And I will definitely – it will help sway me a little bit. The herbicide one, yeah, I mean – yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a mutagen or not, but the fact that some will survive and then have, you know, far fewer, you know, competition, less competition, that's, I mean, sure, that could increase, you know, the mutated weeds out there. I can see that. Yeah, the second one, 10,000 time increase of the catalyst. I specifically was thinking in biology. I guess it doesn't need to be within biology, but I would think that 10,000 is just so huge. I mean, wouldn't that just increase the amount of heat that's generated by an unacceptable amount? Well, I don't know. I never really took chemistry though. I took astronomy instead in high school. So what do I know? but I'd say that one's fake anyway.
And Evan,
54% of teenage girls. Well, that seems like a low number, right? That's what's shocking here. But that doesn't mean it's not true. The other one, the 10,000. Times of the maximum speed. Wow. Catalysts and chemical reactions. We're not talking about a specific catalyst and a specific chemical reaction.
No, it's like any, almost, you know.
Right. That one leans towards fiction, if you ask me. What about this herbicide one? Increasing the mutation rate? How long have we had? Commonly used herbicides. Okay. We've had these things for a long time. Wouldn't they have realized that the mutation rate was changing a long time ago if that were the case, though? That's the problem with this one. 30, 40 years. I don't know. The Roundup's been around a real long time, among others. Wouldn't they have been able to measure that a while ago? Maybe they can only recently pinpoint it. Jeez, I don't know. Okay, fine. Nobody chose the weed one, right? So I'm going to choose the weed one. I'm going with weeds. Fiction.
Steve will not be swept.
Exactly.
Okay, Evan, you're departing from your fellow rogues and going striking out on your own.
He's going rogue.
Dangerous country I'm venturing.
So I guess since you guys are evenly, you picked all three, so there's no reason not to just take these in order. So we'll start with number one. A new study found that only 54% of teenage girls given a prescription in the ER for a sexually transmitted disease filled the prescription. Jay, you think this one is the fiction? And this one is science.
Damn.
This is surprising.
So
these are girls that were diagnosed with pelvic inflammatory disease or tested positive for chlamydia.
Oh,
now, chlamydia. If you've ever worked in an emergency room, you'll know what PID is because it's a very common ER admission. And this is one of the things where you diagnose when they walk into the emergency room because they have the PID shuffle.
Poor girl.
No, because yeah, they're in pain. They can't even walk normally. You could see by the way they're walking. Like, yep, she has PID. So imagine you're having, you know, you're in pain. You are symptomatic. That's what brought them into the emergency room. And you either you have it clinically or you test positive for chlamydia. You're given an antibiotic. So this is not herpes because these were antimicrobials, right? And you then almost half don't take it. So that is very disappointing. That is,
well, don't fill it.
They don't fill it. They don't fill it.
They don't
yeah,
fill it. They don't fill it. They don't take
that's the thing.
It.
Some may fill it and not take it. It's hard to imagine that they're doing that. So this is a retrospective cohort study. They looked at two different emergency departments in a large urban tertiary care children's hospital, enrolled adolescents between age 13 and 19. And yeah, 54% filled the prescription. So they say they need to do a follow-up study where they try to identify the barriers to filling the prescription. So this study did not look at that. And so your speculation is reasonable, Kara, but we don't know. And we definitely need to figure this out. Is it money?
But I hope that they look at money and stigma.
Is it stigma? You know, whatever. Yeah. But who they're suffering through this rather than treating it. Mm-hmm. And of course, because it's a sexually transmitted disease, going untreated is just going to perpetuate it. You know?
Of course, but they might be more scared of their parents than they are aware of how necessary treatment is.
Wait, aren't their parents bringing them to the ER?
Probably not.
Not necessarily.
Wow.
Yeah, probably not. Or if they are, they're lying about what is wrong and the parents are asked to leave the room.
Yeah.
When they're giving the results.
Well, we always do that, by the way. If you have, if a child, you know, a teenager comes into the emergency room or whatever, at some point we're going to say, we're going to ask the parents to leave the room. And if it's a minor, they don't have to.
No, but it's the only way you're going to get a true answer.
Yeah, but we kind of like give the parents a look. You know, it's like we need to have a talk.
It's best if you're not here.
Yeah, it's like, and most parents get it. You know, some parents are very, very protective. But however, the exception is if you suspect child abuse, then you can have the parents physically removed at that point. Then the gloves come off. Because then you're 100% your responsibility is for the child, and you do whatever it takes.
Yeah. And you're a mandated reporter. You legally have to report it.
You have to report it.
They take their latex gloves off. Isn't that like a microbial issue then?
All right. So we have to solve this problem, though, because that's really bad.
We need to be giving these kids the drugs instead of having them fill it on their own.
I agree.
Give them a bottle of pills to walk away from. Yeah. The hospital.
It'd be cost effective. Yeah. That's the thing. It'd be cost effective to do that, to give them free antibiotics.
Yep.
Okay. Item number two. Scientists have found a method for increasing the maximum speed by which catalysts can increase chemical reactions by 10,000 times. Bob and Kara, you think this one is the gotcha? And no, you think this one is the fiction.
I think this one's fiction, but I also think it's the gotcha. Yeah.
Evan and Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is
say it
science.
God damn it.
It is science.
Shit. That means Evan won.
Yes. Oh, good job, Evan.
I almost went with that one as the fiction.
This was the gotcha. And I actually forgot to include an important little detail that would have made it even more interesting is that this limit has been in place since 1960. So this is like 50 years in the making here, almost 60 years. So here's the original limit, the current limit, I should say, is what's something called the Sabatier principle. And what this is, if you think about it this way, so a catalyst is something that increases the speed of a chemical reaction. Obviously, they're extremely useful in industry because if whatever you're producing, you know, any chemical that you're producing, mass producing for the market, or any drug that you're making or anything like that, you want the reaction to be quick. And sometimes the catalysts are necessary to take reactions from being glacially slow to occurring on human lifespan, in a human time frame, or occurring in a manufacturing friendly time frame. So they're like basically the reactions don't happen at any kind of significant rate without the catalyst. But there's a limit, and the limit, the Sabatier principle, is this idea of a Goldilocks zone, of a sweet spot, where if the catalyst and the reactant bind too loosely, then the catalyst doesn't work. And if it binds it too strongly, then it won't let go at the end of the reaction. So it's got to bind it just enough to make the reaction happen, but still release it and reset for the next reaction, right? So at that sweet spot, that's the limit. That's basically the maximum speed with which that catalyst will increase that chemical reaction at the saboteur limit. So, and for the last 60 years, that's been the fastest that catalysts work, any catalyst for any reaction, right? So what they did was they essentially applied a wave of energy to the catalyst itself, which could be just like a piece of metal, right? Metals mm-hmm. are often good catalysts. And if they dialed the frequency to the resonance frequency of the reaction, it dramatically increases the reaction rate up to 10,000 times. So that
is a peak on the peak. Love it.
Exactly. It's like a peak in the peak. And, wow. and so that this could be huge. Imagine if, and Jay, you're right, that for some reactions it may not make a difference, but for others, I mean, imagine if, you know, the process by which we're making useful industrial chemicals or pharmaceuticals or whatever is could proceed thousands of times faster. And especially if that's the rate limiting step in the manufacturing of whatever. So this is still like the technology of technology. This is not an application. This is just a new way of making stuff. So we'll see, you know, what happens when this starts to get implemented in industrial chemical processes. But this is one of those things that could be widespread in its application as like the assembly line. You know what I mean? It's a basic industrial technology that we're talking about here. And again, it's one of those things that people don't think of that much who are not experts, like thinking of catalysts and chemical reactions. But actually, chemical reactions are what our modern world is built on. You know what I mean? When you really think about it, just about everything that we do is a chemical reaction.
It's also what your body is built on.
Yeah.
The brain.
Enzymatic reaction.
Yeah, and I don't know if this would apply to enzymes, to bio catalysts.
Yeah, I think there's probably a bio limit.
This is more
of like ATP and stuff.
They talk mainly about metal catalysts here, but so we'll see. This could have wide ranging implications.
Is anyone speculating? Somebody must be speculating about what this could mean. No, nobody.
Oh, sure.
Well, yeah, we're here, man.
They're talking about like ethanol plants, for example. It could dramatically reduce the cost of producing pretty much any chemical. So we'll see. We'll have to see how this gets implemented. But that hitting upon that idea, we'll just use some kind of resonant frequency to increase that optimal point of making the enzyme do what, not the enzyme, the catalyst do what it does. It's brilliant. And it worked out beyond their wildest dreams, 10,000 times. Amazing. So
Steve, you got to tell me.
Yeah.
Is the operative phrase in the last one, increase the mutation rate?
Yes.
But it's not actually a mutagen. I knew it.
So
I knew it. So the evolution's still happening. It's just not a mutagen.
Yes, exactly. So number three,
a new
study finds that applications
of
commonly used herbicides. You heard me
even say it.
I know. believe me. Use increase the mutation rate in weeds, making the emergence of resistance more likely, is the fiction because the study showed the exact opposite. They were looking to see that. Now, it is definitely true that when you apply an herbicide to a field of plants, of the weeds that are naturally resistant are the ones that will survive, and then they will predominate. So, yes, that's just evolution. But the question the researchers had was, does the application of the herbicide itself cause new mutations to arise? Is the resistance the product of a new mutation, or is the resistance something that was always there in the wild type to begin with? And so they were studying a amaranthus, which is a very common weed that plagues, you know, crops. And they produced 70 million seeds from a single plant. I guess this plant produces a lot of seeds. They said one good plant could produce 100,000 seeds. So they took one plant, they did a few generations, they got it up to 70 million seeds. I think just probably two generations would do that. 100,000 seeds from 100,000, whatever, how many plants. And then they planted it, they applied the herbicide, they found the ones that were resistant, and they were able to track back the genetic features that created their resistance to the wild type. In other words, it was not a new mutation. It was something that existed already.
Damn it!
In the
I feel like I should have known that. I did know that.
And in fact, they didn't find any new mutations causing resistance in their test plot. So
that's good news.
Yeah, it's good news. It's good news. This is what 70 million seeds. They basically said that the mutation rate was a lot lower than they thought it was, and the reason why they thought that it might cause this is because plants under any stress will increase their mutation rate. Just ultraviolet radiation will do it. Mm-hmm. So like anything, just sort of, you know, you stress out the plants and it tends to increase their mutation rate, but apparently not commonly used herbicides, at least not the ones they looked at in this study. So that is a little reassuring. It doesn't really change the basic fact that you're going to still generate herbicide resistance by overusing it, and you still need to use them, you know, with integrated pest management and use them intelligently, just like antibiotics. You can't just use them willy-nilly, right, Bob? I know that drives you nuts. You have to use them intelligently. Absolutely. This doesn't change that, but it is reassuring. At least there's one layer on this one layer that at least it's not generating spontaneous mutations causing the resistance. The resistance is there in the wild type to begin with. Yeah. But I thought that would get a lot of people. You were close, Kara.
Going first is the worst.
I know. Well, you went last time. Last time you went, you were last. So your turn to go first. I try to balance it out.
Fair.
But
whatever.
Evan, I was sweating you, Mel. I thought, oh, man, I'm going to get a sweep. Unless Evan strikes out on his own, then you did one. Good job.
It was a total guess.
Yeah. It's a smart play. It's a strategic move there,
other
Evan.
Than a guess.
All right. Well, Evan, give us a quote.
All right. This quote was furnished courtesy of listener Stephen Hopkinson. Thank you, Stephen. And it comes from, it's the opening monologue from the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. I don't know.
Ooh,
if anyone...
I've been watching that.
Oh, I have not. I can't
I've
wait.
Heard
to...
about it.
I watched the first episode. It's very good.
Yeah, I've watched all but the final episode is next week, so I'm all caught up. It's super good. You guys, you should watch it.
Yeah, don't we're watching it. It's really
don't
good.
Tell
it's,
us how it ends.
I mean, you know, you know the story. It's challenging to tell a story that you already know, but of course, there's the story behind the story.
Yeah.
Seeing it happen, like, holy shit, what are they doing? You know, like,
I know.
It is amazing because we know the end. We know, like, seeing them rationalizing, well, it's not so bad. Like, yes, dude, it is bad. But
bad.
Yeah, it's
like,
definitely
history,
watch it.
Bad.
Yeah.
It's also really, like, well acted, beautifully shot. It's well done.
I have just this one scene. Just one scene I'm going to spoil for you. Just one right. Scene, very quick. Is that stands out is the main guy who's in denial about the severity of the leak is like in the process of telling his supervisors that nothing is happening when he just vomits all over the table because he has massive radiation sickness.
Yeah.
Oh,
so it
gosh.
Tells you, like, it's fine.
Nothing to see here.
No spoilers, but that denial continues throughout the series.
Oh, yeah. We know that, right? We know that, but it is, it's amazing. Oh, there's so many things. Guy, he picks up this, you know, graphite. What's this? That guy's dead. Yeah. You're dead.
Oh,
he's dead.
You're dead.
Yeah.
You're dead.
I don't think
dead.
I knew
Shut
the
up.
Story, but I don't think I knew the intensity of the like the severe. I mean, I knew how severe it was, obviously, but like seeing it there, number to number, like as it progresses through the series, they talk a lot about the science, and they do a pretty good job with the science, and it's really well done.
Oh, that's good.
It's amazing. Yeah. Again, just one other thing that struck me was when. One of the guys is reporting that the measured radiation levels were whatever. He gives a number.
3,000, whatever.
3,000.
Is it Rankin?
And then he's like,
Rankin or whatever.
But he says, but that's the highest that the counters go. That's the highest that. But the guy completely ignores the second part and says, oh, 3,000, that's not too bad. It's like, yeah, but I just said that was the highest that the meter goes.
Yeah,
but
we need to get a more sensitive
meter. It.
What are the chances that it peaks right at the capacity of the device you're using?
But that's
not
it's
good.
Beyond incompetence. That's why the series is so good, because as you follow it, you see that it's propaganda.
Yes.
The whole series is about propaganda and the confluence of like the worst accident sort of potentially in human history combined with a government that's so cloaked and refuses to admit. So only when, you know, there's radiation showing up in Switzerland.
Right.
Only when there's radiation showing up or in Sweden.
They
can
no
I can't remember wherever it was.
Contain it.
Yeah, and they can no longer. But even still, they're going to hide it up to the point just what other people know.
And that's the thing. It's like it's not incompetence. It was the culture. It was the culture.
It's the KGB.
Yeah. Nothing is wrong. We have to pretend that everything's fine. Mm. Even in the middle of the worst nuclear accident in history, we have to, like, everything is fine.
And yeah, they didn't even not quarantine, force the people out.
Yeah, God. They didn't evacuate.
Evacuate. Yes, they didn't even evacuate for like days because they didn't admit to themselves that they needed to.
Yeah.
And that's why the opening monologue.
And Evan, give us the quote is perfect with that in the background.
Sorry,
see, I'm trying this new thing where I sometimes talk about the source even before the quote, and then things like this happen. But it's good. It's good. It's a change of pace. Opening monologue goes like this. What is the cost of lies? It's not that we'll mistake them for the truth. The real danger is that if we hear enough lies, then we no longer recognize the truth at all. What can we do then? What else is left but to abandon even the hope of truth and content ourselves instead with stories?
That is a fantastic quote. Yep. So applicable to
so relevant
to the today, current yeah. to the current time.
Oh yeah, my gosh. Right? Apply that one to so many things.
But I think we all know what we're applying that one to right now.
Timeless.
Yes.
It's a timeless quote.
It's timeless and
yet
timely.
Especially timely.
And timeless and timely. Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Written originally by Craig Mazin, M-A-Z-I-N.
Yep. Very nice. All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure. Yes, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.